Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started this morning. Once again, I want to thank you for joining us. My name is Joe Sheely. I'm Vice President of Communications for U.S. Meat Export Federation. This is our regular conference call that we hold whenever we have one of our Board of Directors meetings. I would like to ask you all to please mute your phone until the question and answer period. If you can keep your phone on mute until we go to questions, then once we're at questions, I will I'll take them in general order and ask you then to keep your phone on mute until you ask a question, and then please give your name and your media outlet and the person to whom your question is directed. I'm going to introduce our panel today. We have, first of all, Philip Tseng, USMEF President and CEO based in Denver. He's joined by Joel Haggard, who's our Senior Vice President for the Asia Pacific based in Hong Kong. Also have Chad Russell, who is our Regional Director for Mexico and Central America based in Mexico City. And John Brook is here. He is our Regional Director for Europe, Russia, and the Middle East, and he is based in Brussels. So to keep things moving along here, I think I'll turn it over to Philip Tseng. And once again, once Phil's comments are through, we will go to Joel, Chad, and John, and then we will take all questions once they've completed their opening remarks. So, Phil, you want to kick things off?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. First of all, I'd just like to welcome you to the call, and at this nice early hour, I appreciate the fact that you're able to be with us. We're here in St. Louis. We're basically at our Board of Directors meeting and product showcase. What distinguishes this meeting from some of our other meetings is the fact that we have probably close to 150 very qualified buyers from all corners of the world. We have 17 trade teams here, and these teams are comprised of buyers both from the food service, the retail, further processors, and they're here to basically look at what we call the showcase, where we have our major exporters have booths that'll be going on this afternoon, and there'll be an exchange, and then there'll be actual transactions that'll be conducted. And this gives our wider membership, if you will, the opportunity to observe, you know, how the export sector of the industry works and how they work with our international partners to continue to put meat, U.S. meat, on the world's table. I would say when we take a look at this year thus far, we've been challenged, as you know, on the beef side. Just through March is the reporting statistics that we have. We're up about 2% on volume, and we're down about 13% in value. If we take a look at the pork complex as well, we're up about 2% in volume, but down about 9% in value. And then again, when we take a look at the lamb complex, I think that we're up 18%, which is, I think, very encouraging, but we're still down 16% on value. And of course, I think you all know that our prices have trended a little bit lower recently. And so I think that's reflected in these export numbers. But I think the encouraging thing is that we do have our numbers are up. I would say that at this meeting, you know, we face many, many challenges. I think the export landscape is always changing. It's always becoming more complex. I think one of the things that has been a major impact on the industry in the last couple of years has been the closure of the Russian market. A good portion of our program is going to talk about the ramifications of the closure of that market, and so we'll have a complete session on that and then the attendant ramifications of that closure. Also, exchange rates have been something that we deal with. At the USMEF, we don't like to excuse ourselves because of exchange rates, because I think there's things that we can do to try to overcome that. So we're going to have a session here at the meeting this afternoon talking about exchange rates and what we can do to overcome the impact of the higher dollar when we try to export in these various markets, which of course makes it more expensive for the countries who are buying the products when the dollar is strong. I would say that also in this meeting, you know, we're going to talk some in detail about the trade agreements, the challenges, the issues. I think that we all know that TPP has been concluded. I think that, you know, in our name, it's called the U.S. Meat Export Federation. So obviously export is in our DNA, and exports are very important to the industry. They have played a very important role to the industry. Yesterday I remarked that over the last 30 years, if you take a look at just Japan, we've exported over $60 billion worth of meat to Japan. Over the last 30 years, that's about $2 billion a year. That's quite a performance. That's really a trading partner when you can do something like this. I think also when we look at these trade agreements, I'm reminded of the fact that in Japan at this point in time, you have the G7 summit that is going on. And of course, there's different sections that they have in that summit where it's partitioned and they talk about different things. But one of the pledges that's already come out of this is that the Europeans and the Japanese have pledged to complete their EPA, their Economic Partnership Agreement, by the end of the year. One of the things the Europeans are most interested in Japan, of course, would be the car issue and also pork. So, we have a situation right now as a result of the Australian EPA, where the Australians have a decided advantage over the United States as far as the tariffs are concerned, both on chilled and frozen, by over 10%. So we don't want to see the same thing occurring when it comes to pork, because the Europeans have become a juggernaut when it comes to pork in the market. I think another area that we see is very important is the competition. We're seeing rising competition in almost every market that we deal in. I think the world is very much aware of the benefits of trade, and we're seeing some of the countries we deal with where actually over 50% of their production is exported. They're very, very aggressive. And so what we see in these markets, and a lot of these markets would be new markets to a lot of these competitors, all the fervor and all the enthusiasm that goes along with finding a new market, we're seeing that as we work to maintain and actually defend the markets that we're already in. I think also the other area that's out there, and of course there's going to be talk, of course, about a new farm bill, and that's those talks are beginning to surface here and there. I think it's very important that we really take a look at what we can do as far as the trade mandate in the farm bill. I'm reminded of an Agrolytica study that was done a couple of years ago that talked about the fact that the Europeans spend $1.8 billion on trade promotion for their agricultural products. And I think that one of the things that we need to really take a look at as we have TPP and as we have TTIP and we have other trade agreements, we always talk about these trade agreements, and then in conjunction with that, we talk about TAA. And I think there's one step in between there, that the way we dignify these trade agreements and the way we garner our market share is we have very sound programs, marketing programs. We do everything we can do to assist our industries to be successful to take advantage of these agreements. And I think there's a kind of a thinking that once you have the agreement, well, that's all there is to do. In our opinion, as we've looked around as these things have unfolded over the years, that's when it really gets interesting. So I think that there is one step between a trade agreement and TAA, and that's doing everything that we can do to promote our products and enable our industry to become more effective internationally. We've had some milestones here just in the last 6 months. We've seen Israel open up to beef. We've seen Taiwan just recently open up to lamb. And we've just seen here in the last 60 days beef and pork being shipped to South Africa. So I think we're encouraged by those moves. And I've kept this quite general at this point in time because we do have our international directors here who are specialists in the areas that they represent. So what I'll do is I'll close for now, and I'll ask our directors then to proceed. And of course, we'll look at a later time for your questions this morning.
All right, thank you, Phil. We'll move next to Joel Haggard. Joel is our Senior Vice President for the Asia Pacific. That includes not only China, Hong Kong, but also Japan, South Korea, Southeast Asia. So if you want to kick it off, Joel.
Sure, and good morning, everyone. And I will, like Phil, I'll present kind of a broad brushstroke of major trends that I see in my region, the Asia Pacific region. And as Phil said, last year we faced a number of headwinds. We had currency issues. There was mountains of EU pork that were available to export into a pork-hungry Asia last year. And we had low Australian beef prices last year and a lot of product availability from them. But it looks a little brighter this year in Asia for the United States and in overall trade. I think we're going to see some positive developments. On the beef side, I think the big trends in North Asia are the rising domestic prices in two of our big markets. That's Japan and Korea. So we're going to see some much larger beef import volumes this year simply because the domestic beef industry prices, they're in their down cycle right now. And so prices have hit historical highs. That's created this gap that's been too much for the consumers to take. And so we see a shift not only from much more expensive Australian beef to U.S. beef, but even some U.S. beef being substituted for domestic beef. So for those of you that have remembered the saga of U.S. beef in Korea and the BSE hangover and the difficulty we had with consumers and the media and over questions about U.S. beef safety and production integrity, those have largely faded into the background and at a time where these other macro factors are aligning with us. In Japan, the first quarter, the yen was up. Our export performance during that quarter, a little weak, but I think it looks favorable going out for the rest of this year. The Wagyu prices, like Korea, they're not up they're not up 30% like they are in Korea, but they're up 15 to 20%. That creates opportunity for us. And then you do have that situation of the higher Australian prices, which is creating some opportunities for us. So I think Japan looks a little firmer this year for us. The other story I'll report, but not much impact on the U.S., is record beef imports into China. We continue to sit on the sidelines of that market, but they're going to have record beef imports again this year. Their quarter one imports were up 85%. That's direct imports. So as is generally known and reported, there's direct and there's this large volume of unknown volumes moving into China through the gray channels. It's very difficult to get a handle on those metrics. But overall, the beef consumption in China is increasing. It's a market we just can't tolerate to be out of. It's the fastest growing beef market in the world. On the pork side, the big story in the region is the Chinese pork shortage. It caught everyone a little bit off guard. Everyone thought last fall there was a slight sell-off in November. Everyone thought that the pork cycle was turning and that additional production was on its way. That proved not to be the case. Chinese New Year, which is like our Christmas and our calendar New Year rolled together, came, and then in that post-New Year season, when demand is supposed to be very slack, China just started buying pork from everywhere in the world. And they just reported April numbers huge, and we're talking 10,000 containers a month. The U.S. has been able to take advantage of that because we have new plants that have been relisted and made eligible for China. But as Phil alluded to, it's still mainly a European market. I think the last statistics I saw, they're at a 78% market share. 80 to 85% of Europe's pork exports come to my region. But China's been amazing. The volumes are going to be just massive this year. And even for us, with a limited number of plants exporting, we're forecasting possibly an additional 200,000 tons of U.S. pork will go to China this year. The big question, of course, is when the market's going to turn. The China pork cycle, it's somewhat predictable in terms of the peaks and the troughs, but that's the big question right now. When is it going to turn? With producers making U.S. $100 a head, there's incredible demand out there by anyone that can grow hogs to grow them. And we see that production coming. We just can't say exactly when it's going to turn. So those are the major points. I do want to mention about Japan, following up on Phil's comments. I know we talk, here in MEF, we talk about Japan a lot, but there's still a very high-value market. Despite higher pork production in Japan this year, they're off to a very big start on pork imports overall. They're going to be, it's a record pace for quarter one this year, and it's a record pace for our chilled pork imports. For the United States, long-term, we don't want to compete in the global market based on price. We want to try to decommoditize and add value to the product. So throughout the region, we're always looking to push the chilled. We're off to a very good start this year. It's a record pace for total chilled pork imports, and it's a record pace for U.S. pork imports. That's kind of interesting because last year it was low because of the port strike here. But still, even going back through the historical numbers, this is going to be a record pace. So I think I'll stop there and take your questions later. And then I think, Joe, any numbers you need from us, we can provide those later.
All right. Thank you, Joel. We'll move next to Chad Russell. As I mentioned, he's based in Mexico City, oversees Mexico and Central America. I also should have mentioned the Dominican Republic, which has been a strong performer this year. So, Chad, you want to give us an update on your region?
Yes, good morning, and thanks for joining the call. I'll give you just a brief overview of pork and beef situation in Mexico to start off. Let me start with beef. Last year, Mexico remained the largest foreign market for U.S. beef in terms of volume. That's in spite of rather a sharp downturn since 2008 in our ability to export U.S. beef to that market. Last year, we were down 7%, and through March of this year, we're down another 14%, unfortunately. So we're certainly not exporting as much beef to Mexico as we used to, which is unfortunate. But some of the major factors that are contributing to that less than bright outlook is the deep recession, of course, after the financial crises. Mexico has clawed itself back in terms of economic growth, but it still hasn't been robust growth there in terms of GDP. And one of the bigger headwinds, and Phil alluded to that earlier, although we never want to make it as an excuse, is the devaluation of the peso. A day or two ago, I checked, it was 18.5 pesos per dollar compared to, it was $10, 10 pesos to $1 back in August of 2008. So our product in pesos is very, very much more expensive and out of reach of too many consumers in Mexico. And also, obviously, we had some relatively high U.S. beef prices, record prices, not that long ago. Now, granted, they've come down quite a bit in recent months. But there is reason to be optimistic for Mexico. And Mexicans' herd rebuilding is behind that of the United States. The Mexican cattle producers dealt with serious drought a couple of years ago. They exported record levels of feeder cattle out of Mexico into the United States. So there's not a lot of cattle in Mexico. And there's not a lot as much domestic beef in the market. Mexican packers right now are under some considerable pressure. Cattle feeder prices are still high in Mexico, and they're trying to buy those cattle to slaughter, and they're very high prices, and they can't pass that on because the beef products produced from that are lower prices. So there's a real financial pinch that the packers there in Mexico are facing. We don't see that being relieved anytime soon. There's about a 50% overcapacity in Mexico as well. So the weak peso also contributes to a higher cost of grains in Mexico. The thing you have to remember also is Mexicans love beef. They're beef-focused or centric culinary country, if you will. So once the prices get more aligned, we believe that the Mexicans will start consuming more beef. There's been a huge shift of consumer preference in the meat protein area from away from beef to relatively less expensive pork and poultry. That's occurred over the last 6, 7, 8 years. Obviously, petroleum prices have gone up, and that will help Mexico's economy. We don't know, of course, it could drop back down again, but still they're quite a bit lower than what the government's budget's based on, I think $70 a barrel. So we're not back to that level yet. So the government has had to reduce their budget significantly two times. All of that puts a little bit of headwinds against the economy there. So overall, we think once the prices get more aligned, and assuming the peso doesn't further devalue, we think there's pent-up demand there, and that won't be able to be met by the domestic industry. So let me now turn to pork, which is a much brighter picture. Last year, Mexico remained the largest volume foreign market for U.S. pork. I checked the numbers before I came to St. Louis. Mexico accounted for almost 34% of all U.S. pork exports. So over a third of all U.S. exports of pork went to Mexico in 2015. That has trended up consistently over the last 4 to 5 years. It's primarily a ham market. The start off this year, we're down about 11% through March off of record levels. We've had four consecutive record level exports to Mexico. It would have been six had it not been in 2011 when the Mexicans put in retaliatory duties due to the NAFTA trucking issue. Those duties nicked our exports and gave more share to Canada at that time. Anyway, those duties have been lifted, and we've been on a very consistent upward trend. There was excess inventory in the market at the beginning of the year because of the volumes they imported at the end of last year. Those inventories, we believe, now are being worked off. I got some data through April based on import documentations, and April was a very good month. We're back up to what we had April of last year. So I think the turn has occurred, and we're optimistic that will continue and exports will start to pick up again for the remainder of the year. Mexican production, they still are suffering from PEDV virus, although the government won't necessarily admit it. They say it's always under control, but we have information that indicates that that's not the case. So the problem with Mexico, well, actually it's good for us, is they continue to produce more pork, but not as fast as consumption. And this has been occurring for a long time. And Mexico is becoming more dependent on imports through time. Last year, 43% of all the pork consumed in Mexico was imported. And they get about 85 or 90% of that from the United States. So essentially, Mexico is not capable of producing what it needs and requires. And the United States is very well positioned due to the NAFTA and the duty-free access and the proximity to the market to provide the Mexican industry chilled pork and the volumes they need in a few days. So we're in a very, very strong competitive position. Again, I'm optimistic for further growth of pork into Mexico. I say that because Mexico still has a young, growing population, growing about 1.2% a year. I think 40% of the population is 25 years of age or younger. As I mentioned a minute ago, Mexico really can't produce the amount of pork currently that it requires. There's water constraints. There's high feed costs. They import almost all their corn from the United States, so it's at least a dollar more a bushel landed in Mexico versus, say, in Iowa. High cost of capital. So there's a lot of reasons why the Mexican industry won't be able to meet the demand of the future, and the United States should gain the lion's share of continued growth there. So let me stop there, I guess, to allow my colleague John time to speak, and we welcome your questions at the end of the session. Thank you.
Okay, next we'll hear from John Brook, whose title is a regional director for Europe, Russia, and the Middle East, but his duties have sort of expanded in recent years, also covering some of the countries in Central Asia and also overseeing activities not only in South Africa, as Phil mentioned, but also in West and Central Africa, some of the emerging markets that we see showing promise there. So go ahead, John.
Thank you, Joe. Good morning, everybody. So let me start in the area where I'm based. I live in Brussels, in Belgium, and there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe at the moment. As you know, Europe is facing some of the toughest times it's had probably since the Second World War. In 2015, we had some 850,000 refugees arrive from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. And this is straining the European political system. It's making people think about what is their identity, what is their role within Europe. And we're seeing now some some potential situations developing which could have a major impact on the shape of Europe. So the United Kingdom's having a referendum in June on whether to remain a member of the European Union. In Spain now, they had an election in December. They've been unable to form a government. In Austria, they just had a presidential election where a far right-wing nationalist candidate was just beaten by a very small margin by an independent candidate supported by a Green Party, an environmental party. It's interesting to see that in both Austria and Spain, both of those countries had basically a two-party system since the Second World War, which either alternated in power or were actually governed by coalition. And with everything that's going on in Europe, there's a breakdown of the traditional order of people following major political parties, and there's a development of independent parties and parties which now cover a wider political spectrum from extreme left to extreme right. You have an extreme left-wing government in Greece, and you've got growing nationalism, particularly in France. The UK referendum started as an attempt by the Conservative government to pull back voters from the United Kingdom Independence Party. So that makes things complicated, and it also makes the negotiations between the European Union and the United States on TTIP, it puts them in a different perspective, because it's somewhat forced some European politicians to take positions to reply to populist ideas in Europe and push back on the idea of liberal trade. And in the current circumstances in the political environment in the European Union, even if the negotiators, which is the European Commission and the United States Department of Trade, were able to make substantial progress in such an agreement, it's not at all obvious that Europe would be in any measure capable of actually coming to an agreement between 28 member states to move forward with that trade agreement. So that can have an impact for our business there in the future, or maybe reduce the possibility of having increased business in future in the European Union. In the meantime, despite the fundamental underlying economic problems of the European Union, an absence of growth, high unemployment, a sluggish demand, it's very, very encouraging to see that the demand for US beef meat has remained very, very resilient, and it's actually the presence of US beef meat across the European Union has just grown significantly over the last year. So we are effectively present now in all of the 28 member states. US beef is the most expensive beef in Europe, and some of the higher value cuts can be double or three times, even four times the price of a similarly named piece of beef, a strip loin or a ribeye, from a different origin. The fact is that US beef, with its consistency and its very high quality, is very much appreciated at the high-end sector of the European market. That said, we're also facing problems because under our agreement with the European Union, which opened the duty-free beef quota, we are facing increased competition from other countries which have gained access to that quota, and the US government is having trouble persuading the European Commission to come back to the table and to make some adjustments to the management of that quota to assure the continuation of that business for the United States. As my colleagues have pointed out, Europe is a very big producer of pork. Europe is the world's second largest producer of pork after China, and the world's largest exporter. And with the closure of the Russian market, European pork producers have been under huge pressure, but at the same time, they are surviving. So while smaller, inefficient farmers might be disappearing, the larger, efficient, well-organized people are pushing along, and we've spent some time in our organization looking at the relative position of competition from the European Union, and it's very clear that it's not going to go away. European pork farming is efficient, it's effective. The currency obviously helps, but even with currency fluctuations, we are going to see the European Union being a major competitor and producer of pork. We do have U.S. pork going into the European Union. We have a little foothold in the United Kingdom, so we're very, very pleased that it's there, and we're going to work hard to make sure that we keep that foothold and any opportunity that arises to increase business to a wider section of consumption or processing we will work on. So, having touched on Russia and the European farmers, European Commission would very, very much like to be able to get back into Russia to have the sanctions lifted. This has led to a number of bilateral attempts between different European Union countries, member states, to get into Russia. But for the time being, it seems very clear that the political situation is blocked, and I do not expect to see in the near term any change in that situation. That means for the United States as well, of course, that we have no access for beef or pork to Russia for the time being. So my colleagues from Russia, they are working hard in the greater Russian region. So we've done a lot of seminars, presentations of U.S. beef and pork around all the ex-Soviet Union states. And just to give you an example, here in St. Louis with our buyers teams, the team that we have from my zone is made up of people coming from Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Tajikistan. So you can see the range of countries that we're trying to develop U.S. meat business with. To move over to the Middle East, so Egypt remains the most important market for U.S. beef livers. In 2015, exports were down a little bit. Egypt has had massive problems with foreign currency. So they're very, very short of hard currency, and the ability of importers to obtain U.S. dollars, excuse me, has effectively been a rationing of the supply of dollars, which has made it very, very difficult for people to keep up a steady flow of product into the market. But that said, it still remains a market of some 120,000 tons of variety meats for the United States. Currently, commercially, it's complicated. The liver prices are very low at the minute. It's a difficult situation, but it won't fundamentally change. Egypt, the primary source of protein for Egyptian people is beef livers. So while there'll be moments where the commerce is profitable or less profitable, it will continue. For the wealthier oil-producing states, despite the change in the oil price, business continues. The countries all have significant sovereign wealth funds, and we're seeing as well that some countries, obviously the Emirates, Dubai, has now developed an economy based on tourism. Saudi Arabia is really seriously considering how they can move off this total oil dependency and begin to generate some economic activity which is not based just on the export of oil. And in the meantime, we see a steady development in restaurants, people eating out, change in lifestyle of people now shopping in retail outlets, in malls that you would recognize as being similar to anywhere else in the world, a very rapid change in the Middle East. And we have, there are small markets for beef muscle cuts, but they're valuable markets. It's high value meat, and we're pleased to see that development. As Joe said, we are pleased also now that we have meat moving again, beef and pork moving to South Africa. We've been working now for more than a year and a half, developing contacts and relations across West Africa, where there's been a steady business in variety meats. We've also done a couple of promotions to move some higher quality beef muscle cuts into that area. And with the expected growth in population and purchasing power in Africa, we will continue to work in that market. I'm also very pleased that we have, despite already having to spread my time around between I don't know how many, 90 or 95 countries, we have two new ones, because Israel has now reopened to U.S. beef, and so we will be having a celebratory event in Tel Aviv soon, And also later in the year, in October, we are going to be having an event in Algiers, in Algeria. We don't have market access yet there, but the head vet has agreed to allow us to bring some product in to present and to I hope, to get that market going as well. I pass it back to Joe.
All right. Thank you, John. I want to apologize for our sound effects there. We're having a bit of a thunderstorm here in St. Louis, so you may hear some background noise. But I'm going to go now to the question and answer period. I'd ask you to please, if you can, keep your phone on mute unless you're asking a question. But we'll kind of go on a first-come, first-served basis. First, Tom Stever is here. Tom, I'm going to ask you, do you have a question for anyone on the panel? Tom Stever from Brownfield.
Thank you. Yes, Joel Haggard, you were talking about the BSE hangover and the demand rising for beef in China. Might that demand for beef in China take them, get them over the edge and get us back into that market?
So your questions about China and whether just the sheer need for beef will translate into our access. And I don't think that's going to be the case. I don't think the demand itself will push this across the line. It's still going to require government-to-government negotiations to work on a protocol that meets China's import conditions. And the import conditions for U.S. beef will be the same that other nations face. But I don't think the increase in import volumes and the decreasing self-sufficiency in China will itself drive this agreement faster.
You don't sound like there's a lot of hope in just that bringing us over the top, but is there any indication that we're getting closer, or that is there any hope for that market opening?
That's a question probably we should give to our negotiators, but I would say this. I think over the last year, and I know the years just drag on, we understand a little bit better about their requirements, and we have to align with their requirements. They're going to be strict, and so we also have to be prepared to supply to those strict requirements. And I think at least our industry's in a better position now to understand what this is going to take to meet those requirements, which is no beta agonists, no implants, and traceable cattle for that beef that's going to go to China.
You know, I would also add, this is Phil saying, that the current administration is very, very motivated to try to conclude some type of an agreement with China for beef access. They formulated a China team within the USDA and the USTR, an interagency team. They're very focused on this. And I think that this resolve to try to get this market open hopefully will translate into some kind of opening. But in the time that we've been looking at this, I haven't seen more energy devoted to this issue as there is right now. So I am encouraged that with our Ambassador Max Baucus, who's very familiar with beef and the beef industry, that there is a tremendously good faith effort to try to get this market open here very soon.
Okay, we'll go to the phone now. Does anyone on the phone, would you like to address a question to anyone on the panel? We'll just kind of go first come, first serve.
Hi, I'm Jenny Leonard with Inside U.S. Trade. I was wondering if Mr. Singh could elaborate on what he said, that, you know, we have a trade agreement, and then we talk about TPA and the step in between that you were talking about, if you could elaborate on that. And then on the market access in China for beef, I understand that, I mean, the case has been made for years that, you know, poultry access for China and the U.S. is linked to its beef access in China. So, I mean, I guess the two are linked, and understand that FSIS is now issuing a preliminary rule to see if the Chinese poultry slaughter food safety system can be equivalent to the U.S. And I have heard that, you know, this would open, like, the potential to U.S. beef exports to China? I don't know if you can maybe comment on that.
Okay, I'll take the first question. I think Joel Haggard would be most qualified to answer the second one. In my remarks yesterday to the opening session of the Meat Export Federation's meeting, I mentioned that we're always very encouraged as trade agreements are concluded, and I would say this would range even beyond agriculture. And always within a discussion about trade agreements, there's always concern about the Trade Assistance Authority, TAA. And we know there's always going to be changes and dislocations as trade moves forward because that's just the nature of the economy. The step that's in between, and I think is very important, and that's why I cite the number that came from this study, is the fact that the Europeans have appropriated $1.8 billion to help promote. So once they have a trade agreement, they put tremendous resources behind these agreements in order to dignify these agreements and make them work for their industries. I think there's a thinking in the United States to some degree, and I'm very careful when I say this, that once you get the trade agreement, that's all you need to do. You have a trade agreement. But a lot of these countries also have trade agreements, their trade portfolio, with other countries, and sometimes those agreements are more favorable than maybe what we have. So what I think that we really need to do, and this is just a suggestion, is that we need to, the step in between TAA and a trade agreement, is we really need to have some intensified trade promotion programs that the industry, and we have to have an approach to our industry, to our companies, and to our exporters that we want to assist them in being as successful as possible. I think there's a very good example when you look at FAS, the Foreign Agricultural Service. They have 97 offices and embassies around the world, and they work very assiduously day and night to try to assist our exporters to become more of a factor in the international marketplace. And today we export about $12 to $13 billion worth of U.S. red meat. And I think that this example, I think, is very important. So when we look at the private and the government partnership, we should look at a partnership to become effective overseas. And so what I suggest would be is that once we have a trade agreement, we really intensify what we want to do as far as promotion. In agriculture, that would be MAP and FMD and checkoff programs and private contributions. But we really need to do this before we have the TAA. The TAA, of course, we have to have because there is going to be dislocations. But I think we can do more in that interim step to assist our industries to become more successful vis-a-vis our very worthy competition in the world's marketplace.
On the issue of the beef access linked to poultry access, I mean, I can't really comment on that, if that's really an agreement tacitly or explicitly, because that's between our two governments. All I can say is I hope it's not, because that's not the way that countries should negotiate access for beef or for any commodity, saying, okay, well, if you give us this, you give us that, especially food products. So we want to be able to meet China's requirement, understand the requirements, meet China's requirement, and show them that we can that we have the systems in place to meet that requirement, rather than have our access tied to another access issues of theirs. That's just, to me, that's just not the way trade, especially in food items, should take place.
Sorry, a quick follow-up. Is that what the China team within USDA and USDR are focused on, or?
Could you speak up just a little bit? We're having a little trouble hearing you. We have some outside noise. Could you speak up a little bit on your follow-up question?
Sorry. Yeah, obviously. I was just following up on this when you said this is not how trade should work or market access should work, that it's linked to one commodity. But so what exactly is the USDA and USDR China team doing? What are they focused on? When you said they're very motivated to get this market access?
Well, we assume they're working on a protocol. So every country that now exports beef to China has a protocol, and those protocols are, and they're quite detailed documents. And, I mean, we would hope, again, we're not party to the negotiation, but we'd hope that the U.S. protocol follows the format for beef access protocols of other countries supplying to China and also the protocols that are in place with other importing countries. I mean, we hope it's the same type of process. So, again, China's requirements are strict. So it also requires alignment on the U.S. side to make sure they can meet those requirements. But again, I mean, you know, on the linkage issue, I can't really comment if that's in place or not. We've heard that privately from people. I mean, we hear sometimes in private discussions, people in China will say, well, you know, we import more agricultural products from you than we export agricultural products to you. But that's not the way trade should work, frankly. And again, especially in food products, it should be based, access should be based on meeting the requirements based on science and food safety standards. And that's how I feel these agreements should work.
And I'd just like to add to that, you know, the United States for the last 50 years has been one of the biggest advocates and the leader as far as rules-based trading. And I think that what we found in dealing with China is that the idea that they're going to conform to a worldwide norm when it comes to a lot of these issues, we've seen this play across other commodities in agriculture. But I think the United States still extols that virtue of rules-based trading. And we've seen China, because of the enormity of their market, they're trying to set their own rules. And what we've seen is other countries who maybe in the past where we would have seen more adherence to rules-based trade, they will basically cave in because of the enormity of the market, the potential in that market, and they compromise in these areas. And that's what makes it so much more difficult for the United States to extol and maintain this virtue, as I would call it, of rules-based trade. And so we're seeing this play out more and more, and we're seeing our competition play out more and more. And this is the tension that we have, is trying to find that right balance. And that's also a very strong component, because once you cave in, once you acquiesce to some degree, it's very hard to get back and to what I'd call a rules-based system. So this is very difficult, and the principle is very important here.
Okay, we'll move on to are there other questions from reporters on the phone? Speak up if you have a question for the panel.
This is Joel Haggard. Maybe I'll tackle that. No, I think we can. As I mentioned earlier, we have been very interested to see to watch the experience of other countries that don't have national systems, how they gained access to China. For example, the case of Brazil. I think we're going to do it. I think also we're going to have to be realistic that, like other countries that have gained beef access to China, it's going to take a while to get used to the trade. It's going to be there are going to be challenges at the beginning. It's not an easy country to export meat to, but I think we can meet the requirement. We to Europe, and maybe John can join in. We have to provide meat that comes from traceable cattle. So this wouldn't be an unprecedented requirement. Is it going to be easy? No, it's not going to be easy. It's also going to be costly. But I'm confident there'll be interested parties in the United States that want to take advantage of demand in China to meet these requirements.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Any other questions from reporters on the phone? Got time for just one or two more if someone has a question. If not, we will wrap things up. Okay, thank you very much for joining us. If you have a follow-up question or you need something clarified, you should have my contact information. Just email or text me or call me, and I'll be happy to follow up on that. So thank you again for joining us, and have a great day.
Thank